with the particular structure of the theory that we're interested in. So if you want to now consider this for quantum theory or maybe space-time structure, then one could wonder what sort of activities and relations would be relevant for that. So for quantum theory, quantum theory is somehow about an observer doing measurements on some system, so that the activity that's important here is information acquisition. And the relation that we're interested in is basically the relation between observer and system. So, but then if you wanted to talk about space-time, well, space-time structure is somehow encoded in relations among observers. And we think also about special relativity. That's how Einstein originally developed the theory, by looking at how different worldviews by different reference frames of observers are related. And how can one find out about it? Well, different observers, they can communicate, for instance, by light signals, and then they can try to synchronize their clocks and see then we can see and talk about the relation between those observers. So activity here for space-time structure, that would be somehow the communication, and the relations that we're interested in are actually relations among observers. So in fact, one could even push this a bit further. So actually, space-time has also, in some sense, an informational touch to it. There are some of the structures in space-time, for instance, horizons, they as information barriers, they have an information theoretic essence to it. And but one can, this is actually encoded more deeply in the causal structure. So the usual view on space-time or on causal structure is, of course, that we have a space-time given with a metric and so on that determines what sort of causal structure you have. And then given that causal structure, that somehow governs the information flow that's in that space-time. But one can try to reverse that perspective also, because there exist these theorems by Hawking and Garrett that tell you that the causal structure, at least under mild conditions, in fact implies the space-time structure up to a certain up to scales, and well, somehow the information flow should encode the causal structure. So when the information flow should have also the information about the space-time structure in it. So, and if we are talking about information flow, then somehow, of course, we want to do that by looking at communication. So somehow we would be more interested in having a network where we can communicate. So that's not what I will do here in this talk. I will focus only on the relation between an observer and a system and consider the act of information acquisition and how we get from this to quantum theory. That's this talk, but you will hear a bit about more the relations among observers in the following talk by Markus. He won't really use causality, but he will look at reference frame relations from quantum communication, how you can look at transformation groups from such communication thought experiments and restrictions on it. Okay, so from now on, I want to talk about quantum theory. So quantum theory is, of course, an extremely successful theory. It has passed all experimental tests that we know of. But then at least when, for many people outside of this room, the theory is still defined by operationally obscure textbook axioms rather than physical statements that would somehow be comprehensible. And related to this, it has also evaded a commonly accepted apprehension of its physical content. And that stands in contrast to relativity. But so it's an interest in itself, but also now with the advent of more fundamental theories looming over the horizon, we might want to try to clarify those issues. At least it wouldn't hurt if we could. So, and to ask, so what are actually the characterizing physical features of quantum theory, and how could the world be any different if we dropped some of those characterizing features? And in general, also what to ponder about the question of what quantum theory actually tells us about nature, or about what we are actually allowed to say about nature. So, and in particular, also for a convincing conceptual scheme in quantum gravity, it might be interesting to have some insights on this also, for instance, when it comes to the quantum state, is it real or not? And when it comes to the wave function of the universe, there are many open problems. So we can try to improve our understanding by coming up with an operational axiomatization of quantum theory. That's what we want to do. So here's some more motivation for it, so more precisely. So one of the motivations is to give operational sense to the usual textbook axioms, and only by going beyond the usual formulation of quantum theory, so by departing from Hilbert space structures in the first place, then we can only ask what makes quantum theory special, and so the idea is to derive the usual textbook axioms so that we can understand why we're using Hilbert spaces or complex Hilbert spaces, tensor product rules and unitaries and so on. And then, of course, another motivation is to understand quantum theory within the larger context, as I said before, so in the larger context of alternative theories. Then, as I mentioned, it's also interesting to try to better understand what quantum theory tells us about nature. And then, for instance, when we think about special relativity, the interpretation of many of the weird phenomena, such as Lorentz contraction, time dilation, and relativity of simultaneity, they become intuitively clearer once you accept that there is a universal speed of light. And you can derive that from simple thought experiments. So the question is whether one could also try to understand typical quantum phenomena such as entanglement and so on from somewhat more intuitive insights rather than invoking Hilbert spaces to explain how that comes about. And then we might also find some new structural insights that we didn't have access to before by not looking at it through certain perspectives. So of course, I should mention that there exists already a number of successful reconstructions, mostly in the generalized or operational probabilistic theory framework. In fact, I think most of these, essentially all of the operational reconstruction that I know of, they are somehow represented in this room by at least one author. So they're very beautiful works, in fact. They all of them have, in one way or another, something to say about these 5 points. But here, I would nevertheless like to try to take a novel perspective and try to come up with a new reconstruction, the different philosophy that focuses more on the information acquisition of an observer about a system. And that's also partially motivated by earlier works that I mentioned here. So here's the outline for the remainder. It is organized according to the steps that you need to do in a reconstruction. So the first thing that we need to clarify is, so what sort of landscape of theories are we actually working in? We have, of course, have to presuppose some sort of mathematical or physical structure within we can formulate axioms. I mean, that's the same also when you want to derive relativity theory, then you presuppose a lot of mechanical structure. So we want to, first of all, talk about what sort of landscape what are our pre-assumptions before formulating the postulates. Then I will tell you about what the postulates are. In fact, I will only do this for qubit quantum theory, so a simple subcase. And then thirdly, I will just show you somehow the essential steps or an overview of how you can go about the reconstruction. And the goal here is not to get the very concrete physics, but rather the architecture of the theory, so to derive the formalism. So it's basically a set of all possibilities for qubit quantum theory. Okay, so here's now, now I want to talk about what sort of structure I presuppose physically and mathematically. So the focus that we will have here is, in fact, as I mentioned before, the information acquisition of an observer about a system. And we want to follow the premise that we only want to talk about the information that an observer has access to through measurement or experiment. It's a purely operational approach. So it's an epistemic approach, but it's also it's a very operational approach. We don't want to make any statements about ontic states and so on. So and then here's the setup. So what's the best way of acquiring information? The best way of acquiring information is to ask some questions. And so that's what we want to consider here. So we have an observer who interrogates systems, so an ensemble of systems with binary questions, that will in the end lead me to qubit quantum theory in the way I will do it for simplicity. And I will also ask them to be repeatable. So for simplicity, that will basically give me projective measurements in the end. And then, there will be binary and repeatable questions. There's an observer, he has access to some preparation method, and then he will get a system and will interrogate it with a bunch of questions. Okay, so the basic ingredients then are, there's a certain set of binary questions that the observer may ask the system. So I denote that by Q here. And then the idea is that every method of preparation gives rise to a particular or specific statistics over the outcomes of the questions if asked to sufficiently large ensemble. And then I will consider a sigma to be the set of all possible answer statistics to all possible questions that are contained in the set here. So basically, point and sigma assigns a probability to each of the questions in that set. So now the idea is that the observer has a theoretical model for these two sets here, by means of which he can interpret his interrogations. I mean, that's how we do it in the lab anyway. So we always have, of course, some theoretical model of the world by means of which we interpret our experimental outcomes. The ambition here is not to explain how he has come up with that theoretical model. The ambition is rather, so that would be just by trial and error, how we usually do it. But the question is rather, what is this model subject to a set of restrictions and assumptions that I will summarize. So we'll take a somewhat Bayesian viewpoint on probabilities. Now we think of the observer as some sort of agent who can do statistics over the outcomes of his interrogation. So he can write the results on a piece of paper and do frequency counts and so on. And so in this, this observer can now assign probabilities to the systems. So when he's doing interrogations, he can assign probabilities to the various outcomes of to the questions that he may ask the system according to his degree of belief, which is based on his prior knowledge about that particular system that he may ask. So that can be based from previous interrogations on identically prepared systems. And also it requires his theoretical model of what sigma is, so what the set of all possibilities is. So for instance, when the observer asks always the same question to an ensemble of systems, he always gets the same answer. Then he will just predict that the next time he will ask that question, that the probability is one that he will get again a yes outcome. So, and in this model, the only way that I allow the observer to acquire information about the systems is by interrogation. So that is, these probabilities that you can assign to those to the question outcomes, they encode everything that the observer can say about those systems. And therefore, we will identify this collection of these probabilities for all those questions as being the state of the system relative to that observer. It contains all the information that he has about those systems. And the state space will then be the sigma, the set of all possible answer statistics, and I will require it to be convex for operational reasons. So that is here, in fact, the state is really the observer's catalog of knowledge about that system. So it's a state of information, and that is, in philosophy, not entirely orthogonal to, for instance, Rovelli's relational quantum mechanics, or also the cubism that we've heard about yesterday from Rüdiger Schack. So, but then I also have to tell you a bit about what the prior state is when the observer does some updating of his information in interrogation. So the prior state when he knows nothing is what I call the state of no information. So that will be a state that assigns probability 1/2 to all the questions in the set that he will ask the system. So that's also a restriction on the set of questions. But he has a theoretical model for that. So we don't want to consider here questions that are always yes or no. So basically, we assume that there exists a special way of preparing systems that will give totally random outcomes to the questions in the set that that we're considering him to be able to ask the systems. And then
is that assumption going to be important later?
That
you can prepare a state of the system that's going to give you totally random statistics.
But it is important because I need to tell you what sort of prior you start out with, and I also need it for defining a notion of independence. So it has two uses, actually. Sorry?
No, but here I think because it's more convenient to be Bayesian, because then you're allowed to have these assumptions. It's not preparation of the system, it's your knowledge.
Sorry again, I didn't hear.
I guess that if you're Bayesian, you're allowed to make those assumptions because it's your knowledge and not actual preparation. So then it's easier to take this point.
Fine.
No, I like it. So
okay.
It's not a criticism.
No, I understand. No, that's all right. So and one has to distinguish here is now, in fact, single versus multiple shot interrogation. In a single shot interrogation, you're only interested in figuring out what the state of that particular system is. And this is where a collapse of the state can occur. It will only occur if the information that you gain about that system is distinct from the prior information you had about that particular system from whatever previous interrogations that you have done on identity prepared systems. So basically, a collapse here is kind of identical to an information gain, and you don't really have to interpret it as a literal physical disturbance of the system. And the multiple shot interrogation is in order to estimate, basically to do state tomography, to estimate the state of the ensemble, and thereby asking more and more systems, you would do Bayesian updating and trying to figure out what the state is. So now I need to introduce a bit more structure because we want to talk about the questions, independence, compatibility, and complementarity. And so here's where the state of no information becomes important again. So I will call two questions to be independent if they're independent relative to the state of no information. So basically, if the observer receives a system that relative to him is in the state of no information, and then he asks the question Q1, and then there will be some updating because they're repeatable questions. But if after that updating, the probability for the next question Q2 is still 1/2, then I will call them independent. So basically, you could consider it as being that the probabilities for the joint, that the joint probabilities for the two outcomes to be yes relative to the state of no information, that it factorizes. So the reason I need to use a particular state in order to define independence is because the notion of independence is tied to a state. So we need a special state in order to define what independence is. For instance, if you think of in quantum mechanics, if you think of two qubits, and then you ask about the spin of qubit 1 in x direction and the spin of qubit 2 in also in x direction, they may be independent in a product state, but they are not independent in an entangled state, for instance. Okay, so then,
So even if you ask your question to the state of no information,
yeah.
So this is equivalent to the fact that the conditional probability of Q2 given Q1 is completely flat.
Flat as well, 1/2, like, yeah.
1/2, yeah. So you could possibly define this even for a non-information state. No, you could always say
for another state,
you mean. Complementary to this one.
So this is somehow a special state here in the.
So you say you don't need
But the thing is that then the notion of independence will depend on which state you're looking at, right? So in here, so we want to have a particular notion that is tied to a special state.
Right, if you want to say that compatibility, I mean, this is something common, it's also independent. So
compatible questions don't need to be independent. I mean, it could be they can be dependent as well.
Okay. But then independent is a complementary measure.
So complementary questions aren't necessarily independent, but compatible questions can also be independent. So as for instance, the few. Maybe I should first of all say, compatibility, so here we don't have any notion of algebraic notion of commutators and so on. So compatibility we have to define by means of the structure that we have here. And so I will just define two questions to be compatible if one can simultaneously know the answers to both of them simultaneously. That is, if there exists somehow states in the state space such that both of the probabilities can be simultaneously 0 or 1. And I will define two questions to be complementary if it is impossible to know both of them at the same time. That means if you have maximum knowledge about one question, then you have absolutely no information about the other question. So if the probability for one is 0/1, then the probability for the other one must necessarily be 1/2 for all those states that have this, and vice versa. What I should also say is here, I will always assume these relations to be symmetric. So far we have been talking about the state as being the collection of all probabilities for all questions. So that's of course not a very practical way of parameterizing a state. So now we want to make it a bit more practical. So I will introduce an additional assumption. I will now assume that there exists an informationally complete set of questions, so that there is somehow a maximal set of pairwise independent questions that parameterizes a state in the sense that the probabilities associated to those questions, that they're sufficient to compute the probabilities for all other questions that the observer can ask. So in the sense, I will actually, I mean, as I said before, of course, this will give you qubit quantum theory in the end. So this is, of course, for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces here in the end. So yeah, so that's an assumption. So and then so if there's D, a set of D maximal, maximal set of D pairwise independent questions, then the state space ultimately will be a D-dimensional state space. Okay, so now that we will talk about an observer acquiring information about a system, what will be very important, in fact, is also to have a measure for quantifying the amount of information that the observer has about the system. And I will just make some simple ansatz here. So I will just parameterize the information that O has about some question qi as being some function that I call alpha, and that should only be a function of that probability associated to this question. It should be a function between 0 and 1. And then the total information should, of course, be a function of the state. And then the ansatz that I make is that it should be just the sum of the informations associated to each of the questions in that set, informationally complete set that parameterizes the state. So I will not tell you what the measure is at this moment because that should follow also from the principle. So we will, so that will be derived later on. So there's a few more assumptions that are underlying this reconstruction. I don't really have time to discuss that. So let me directly jump to the postulates now. So here's the rules for information acquisition of an observer about a system of n qubits. So we have now this number n up there that will appear in various places here that will count the numbers of qubits in the end. So the first postulate is what I call limited information. And colloquially speaking, what I mean by that is that the observer can acquire maximally n independent bits of information about the system at any moment of time. And what I mean by this in terms of the question is that there exists a set of a maximal set of n mutually independent and compatible questions, so to which you can get the answers at the same time. And that will define the information limit of n bits. So what I should say, for instance, if you have a single qubit, then you can ask the question just to spin up in x direction, and that's as much information as you can have at any moment of time about it. Once you know what the spin is in x direction, then you cannot know anything else at the same time. So, but then, of course, we know that we can always ask different questions. There exists a notion of complementarity, so I will take it as an empirical input that there exists a notion of complementarity. So I will allow the observer to always be able to ask different questions and gain new information. So the observer can get up to n new independent bits of information about the system. And then I will require that whenever he does that, that he would not experience a net loss of information. So, and in terms of the questions, what I assume is that there exists a second set similar to the first one, which is a maximum set of n mutually independent and compatible questions, but that they are pairwise complementary with the questions from the first set.
So is this J equals I a typo?
Is the, no. So I mean, the what I want to say here is that,
It should just be J, the second subscript.
This one here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so all I want to say is that, so here we're talking about the prime question before the unprimed. So, and I want to say that the prime questions are complementary to exactly one from the other set. So there's pairwise complementarity. So it's basically qi from the first set is complementary to, let's say q1 is complementary to q1 prime, but compatible with the others. That's what I want to say with it. So, and the reason I require it in this way is you can motivate that a bit better by defining what I mean actually by a composite system. I haven't really told you about it, but this particular way that you have pairwise complementarity has to do with a fact that I want to look at this as a composite system of n qubits. Okay, so these first two principles, they're actually motivated by earlier work by Carlo Rovelli, Zeilinger, and Bruckner, but they're not sufficient to get quantum theory, so you have to assume a bit more. So another postulate is what I call completeness. I will allow the information that the observer has about the system to be distributed over all his questions in any way as long as it is consistent with the first two principles. So basically what I mean by this is that I allow any state as long as it is compatible with the first two principles. So this gives you also a notion of superposition. So you can distribute your information now also in non-trivial ways and continuous ways over the questions that parametrize the state, for instance. Then the fourth postulate is what I call preservation. So I just assume that the total amount of information that the observer has about the system is preserved in between interrogations. So by not asking any questions, you shouldn't gain any information, but you should also not lose any information, you know, as long as it is not interacting with any other system. So what I mean by that is that the total amount of information that I made an ansatz for in the previous slide, that it is a constant in between, in time in between interrogations. So the fifth one talks about time evolution. I will require that the evolution of the state is continuous and also allow for it to be non-trivial. And it turns out that these five postulates within the landscape of theories that I'm considering, that it has two solutions, and that's real and complex quantum theory. So it basically gives rise to qubits and rebits. And you could be happy at this stage because rebits are mathematically also a subcase of qubits. And you can even, in principle, produce them in the lab by restricting qubits to, say, a disk in the Bloch sphere. So one could be happy at this stage. But if you want to distinguish between rebits and qubits, you can impose a sixth postulate, which is basically just local tomography. That's also what people use in other reconstructions, which means that you can determine the state of a composite system by only interrogating its constituents. So, in fact, this last postulate is a very strong postulate that's also used in other reconstructions to actually gain a lot of structure. Here in this case, I only needed to distinguish between rebits and qubits. And if you impose this, then, okay, the claim is that the sigma n, so the state space for number n is the space of density matrices over an n-fold tensor product of qubit Hilbert spaces, and that states evolve unitarily, and that the set of questions, they correspond to Pauli operators. So, of course, I cannot derive that now in full generality here. Let me just give you a brief sketch of how you could go about proving this. So, first of all, one can use the principle of limited information and complementarity. The two are actually very powerful. So, and using the two, you can derive the entire question and correlation structure, and so the independence of questions, complementarity of questions, compatibility of questions, and also what sort of correlations are allowed. You can combine the time evolution axiom together with the information preservation axiom to show that you get a reversible time evolution. You also get a quadratic information measure, so you don't get the Shannon entropy. Then you can combine these results, and using the completeness locality axiom, you can show that then that the state space for a single qubit is in fact a ball with three dimensions. So it's just the Bloch ball as we know it. And the time evolution group is the set of all possible time evolutions is SO3. Then the most non-trivial part of the whole reconstruction is the n equals 2 case. So it requires a bit of work. You have to combine all these results, and you can show eventually that in the n equals 2 case, first of all, derive the time evolution group. You can show that it's PSU4. That's what you have in quantum theory. And okay, that the state space is the convex hull of CP3 geometrically. That's also what you have in quantum theory. And then using results from universality in quantum computation, you can then also show that together with these results here, you can get the correct state spaces for all n. So I just want to, how much time do I have left, actually? 5 minutes. So I just wanted to give you a brief gist of how the reconstruction works, some of the underlying ideas. of course, I cannot tell you too much details now. So one of the first questions to ask is, so how many independent questions do you have per n? So in the n equals 1 case, what we know is, of course, that we have complementarity. We don't know how much complementarity there is. But for a single system, we will have some set of questions that will parametrize the state. They all must be complementary because there's only one bit of information that you can know. So if you have, there's at least two of them, but there could be more. Of course, and we know that it should be three. So in the n equals 2 case, you will have a second system. And because it's a composite system, you can also ask all the individual questions about the second system. But then because it's a composite system, you can also ask composite questions. Turns out that the composite questions, I will denote them by a vertex now, by a line connecting vertices. And these composite questions. In fact, they represent the question, are the answers to Qi and Qj prime, are they the same? Are they correlated? So the logical operation in between them is the XNOR. In fact, you could also use the XNOR, the XOR. So you can derive that more thoroughly than I'm doing it here, but that's what you get. In fact, this XNOR here is ultimately related to the tensor product structure in the Pauli operators. So, and then you can actually show that these questions, these composite questions, that they're pairwise independent. And you can also show that what the complementarity and compatibility relations are. So you can show that two composite questions, Q11, for instance, Q31, they are complementary if they intersect in a vertex, and they're compatible if they do not intersect in a vertex. So for instance, Q11 and Q22, they would be compatible. And this is already gives you quite some information also on the possibility of entanglement, for instance. So you can see how entanglement arises in this case, because now, as I told you before, so if you have two composite questions that do not intersect in a vertex, then they are compatible, and they're also independent. So it means the observer can actually spend this maximum amount of two independent bits of information that he's allowed to know by the limited information principle. He can spend it over the composite questions. And you can also show that once he knows the answers to these two questions, he cannot know cannot have any more information about the individual questions. And this is then that's exactly entanglement. And so here I'm just quoting something that also Julie used in his talk yesterday. I hope he doesn't mind the plagiarism. So that's, but it fits here. So Schrödinger said, the best possible knowledge of a whole does not necessarily include the best possible knowledge of all its parts. So that's exactly what you have here. So that's entanglement.
It's nice because in this case you have all the components. No? You have the best possible knowledge of the whole precludes the knowledge.
Ah. no, not necessarily, because you can. You can still have maximum information of the whole and still have maximum information about its constituents, because you could know, for instance, you could ask two individual questions. Mm-hmm. And. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I think I should go on because I have now 3 minutes. But one observation is that it's really a consequence of complementarity. For instance, for classical bit theory, you wouldn't have any of these guys down here. So you would only have those three possible questions. And that means if you want to spend two bits of information, then you would always actually be in a product state. In a state of maximum information, you always have maximum information about the individual constituents. So you can define entanglement as having more information than one bit about its composites. Let me not go into this. You can similarly, in fact, also argue for monogamy by similar arguments. Maybe I skip this. And let me maybe briefly come to how we can argue that the Bloch ball is three-dimensional here. So, So as I said before, if you have now composite questions, we have D1 individual questions. And as long as the composite questions do not intersect, they're compatible. So that means the observer, in fact, can ask all of these questions at the same time. In fact, what I should say is what I didn't tell you before, is I assume that Specker's principle holds, which means that if you have pairwise compatible questions, that they're also mutually compatible. That's one of the underlying assumptions here. So that means that the observer can actually ask all of these D1 questions at the same time and get an answer to all of them. But we know that there's an information limit of 2 bits, so you cannot know more than 2 independent bits of information about the system. So it means, while these D1 composite questions are pairwise independent, they're not mutually independent. So, and that means once you have asked two questions and you have maximum knowledge about the two of them, then they should imply also the answers to the D minus two other questions. And then you can ask yourself, how could they be related? And then you can just write down a simple truth table here. You can do that because they're compatible questions. And you can convince yourself that suppose you have asked Q11 and Q22, how would Q33 be related to those? Then you can figure out that this is the only truth table that works where A is different from B. And then that basically means that Q33 must be the correlation or the anti-correlation of these other two questions. In fact, that's also exactly what you have in quantum theory. In fact, this case is the one that you have in quantum theory. And you can repeat the same argument for, of course, Q44 and so on. But because there's up to negation, unique way of determining that relation, that means you cannot have more than three such composite questions. You can also repeat the same argument for any other compatible question graph. And that means, in general, you cannot have, so D1 cannot be larger than three. But we know it could be two, and we cannot, at the moment, preclude two. So this is actually the origin why you get two solutions here from these postulates. So this here is the Rebit case. That's the qubit case. So I don't think I have very much time left.
A minute and a half.
Okay, so somehow you can derive an information measure here, which I should say, okay, that's you basically, it's the square length of the Bloch vector that turns out to be the useful information measure here. It's this. So the Bloch vector is just 2 times the state vector minus the vector filled with ones. That's a convenient vector because it turns out that it transforms linearly under the time evolution. So in the Bloch vector length is then basically the square is the number of answered questions. And from this, you can also read off that the time evolution group must be a subgroup of SOD1. It's a continuous group, and it's the group that preserves those this information. The information, in fact, must be a conserved charge of time evolution. So I give you just a brief glimpse of how you get the Bloch ball. So from before, if you take the D1 equals 3 case, you have a three-dimensional vector. If you use this information measure, you can now distinguish pure states as being those that have maximum information of 1 bit, because there's only 1 bit that you can know. Mixed states are those where you have less than 1 bit, and the completely mixed state, or the state of no information, is the one where you have 0 bits. If you now allow all those states that satisfy these relations using the completeness axiom, then the set of states that you're left with is exactly the Bloch ball. And the set of time evolutions, in this case, of all possible time evolutions, would be SO3, as in quantum theory. Can derive the correlation structure. So it's actually kind of neat how you get the n equals 2 case. There's a new way of characterizing the pure state space. So what you have seen before, what I just mentioned, is that for an n equals 1 case, for a single qubit, the pure states are characterized by the three Bloch vector components adding up to 1 exactly. So, but that's equivalent to saying that the maximum set of mutually complementary questions carries exactly 1 bit for pure states, and they're characterized by that statement, because each of them, I mean, they correspond to mutually complementary questions. It turns out that this generalizes to 2 qubits as well. You can group all the 15 questions that you get, that you can derive for 2 qubits, into 6 maximal mutually complementary sets, and you can arrange them in pentagons. Each of these pentagons is a maximal mutually complementary set in the sense that each question in here is complementary to every other, and you can actually show that for pure states, each such pentagon carries exactly 1 bit of information. So that's an additional conserved charge of time evolution, if you want. So for instance, for this pentagon 1 here, it's the 5 questions here, the Bloch vector components, the squares of them must add up to 1. And in fact, you can show that these 6 charges requiring that they are conserved by time evolution, that actually leads to exactly the PSU4 group. It's a bit non-trivial to show this. And from this, you can also reconstruct the pure state space CP3. Okay, I think I should basically stop here. So I guess I leave the conclusions for you to read then. Thank you.